A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I'm Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamond.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you, Rob?
Today, Russell, I am feeling like we are all made of stars.
True.
And I'm not referencing our week, which has just been the most mental week here in London for Frieze, where we have literally hung out with some of the world's most iconic stars, including Donatella Versace and Dua Lipa.
Hung out with? We were in the same room.
Yeah, we met Donatella
we
Versace.
We met Donatella.
We had our photo taken with her, but we haven't seen the photo yet. But we love our Donatella. And
should we tell them why we haven't seen the photo?
No. The reason I bring up that reference is actually, it's from a Moby song, which I always used to really, really love that song. And I like the idea that even though we're living in the present and we're here right now, we're actually kind of connected to history and to, I like the idea of that we're kind of like connected to the stars in the sky somehow. And that like we are all from this kind of giant past, a kind of like epic, it's almost like futuristic, but looking backwards, whatever that is. Back to the future. And that is the kind of feeling I get every time that I see today's guest's work.
Yeah.
And there's some kind of more obvious connections to it because the painter that we're about to meet today references art history and often will pick out elements from paintings that have been, you know, made in the past and then kind of contextualize them within her own work. But also there's an element which you can actually see right now at the Hayward Gallery in London and in the group exhibition that we recently spoke to Ralph Rugoff about, where you kind of see these very like elevated kind of moments of almost like film glamour or something, you know, and like actual stars, like in people's
icons,
skin. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Luminosity.
And it's all about light.
Yes.
Which that was
this artist loves light.
Yes.
Loves light.
So we are all made of stars. we would like to welcome to Talk Art,
Louise Giovanelli.
Hey, guys.
Hi.
Hi, thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, no,
it's a real pleasure.
To see you. So you've been in London all week for Frieze?
Yes, I came last Monday and yes, I'll be going back today.
What's your week? Today's Sunday.
Oh, God, tomorrow.
Are you going back Monday?
Yes.
Okay. So you've got another day in London.
Lost track of time. Yes, yeah, it's been great.
And what's it like as an artist coming to Frieze? Because as a gallerist, for me, it's really overwhelming because you have to like meet everybody. But I'm always curious to know how artists feel about an art fair.
It's a funny one. I really enjoy it, but it is a strange experience for you as the artist because it's kind of a bit like, you know, if you eat meat and then you go to the butcher and you see how it's done. It's a bit sick sometimes.
It's a bit Wizard of Oz, like you suddenly see the inner workings.
How it goes down. Sometimes takes a bit of the romance out of it, but other times it's just so exciting because you bump into loads of people and have great conversations and it's like very concentrated. It's like all the art going on at the moment in one room, multiple booths. So yeah, I like it. I really enjoy it.
You had work there this year, didn't you, with Grimm Gallery?
Yes, yeah, I showed in the booth with Grimm, yeah.
And how was that then to see your... Is this the first time you've seen your work at Frieze or has it been here before?
I showed last time at Frieze, but because of this whole corona thing, that was 2 years ago now,
I think. Some cough
that's going around, I don't know. Yeah, yeah, and then in between there was obviously the online art fairs and stuff that were happening, you know, these viewing rooms which I also took part in. But that was the last physical art fair was Frieze 2018, I think.
And that was with Grimm Gallery again?
That was with Grimm, yeah. That was when I first started to work with Grimm. Yeah, so that was also super exciting. Yeah.
And it's interesting because I feel like I discovered your work during this pandemic through the internet. And it's quite an unusual thing because normally you discover someone's work in person. But I feel like your paintings actually really translate in a way through image. But actually in real life, they're very, very different. What was it like for you? Because you must have had that experience a lot, I imagine, with people sort of discovering you and getting excited about you through digital realm.
Well, I'm glad that it works this way around. I think my works do translate quite well through images. I think the whole thing with light that you mentioned earlier on, that comes through.
Filters.
Yes, I think it works. I'm happy that it's not that type of painting that just is completely lost and flattened. I mean, still, it makes a total difference, doesn't it, when you see a painting in real life, but yeah.
Yours especially.
Yeah.
Because yours, you are seeing the image. There's kind of two sides to it. You see the image and you're trying to work out what that is or connect to that. But then the surface of the paintings themselves, you mark them, you scratch them, you allow us to see the multi-layered process that you go into to create these works.
Mm-hmm.
You want to reveal that. You want the audience to see your process as well as enjoy what it is, the finished thing. So there's a conceptualism to it.
Definitely, yeah. I'm very interested in surface and the technicality of painting. And like you said, the paintings are quite layered, very slow process, multiple layers of luminous colour on top of each other. And you really need to see them in real life to get a sense of all of that. And you're right, I'd use these processes that kind of, they interrupt the surface a little bit. There's room for the viewer to kind of peer into the surface, you know, when I leave certain things unpainted, or I scratch something out, or these lines that kind of split the surface, and they're all little windows for the viewer to peer through and to kind of see what the process is before it ends up the finished image.
Why is that? Why do you want that to be part of your language?
Because it's a painting, fundamentally. It's not, otherwise it would just be a photograph, right? Otherwise I'd just be making a picture rather than making a painting. It's a very different thing. I think those are my favourite artists or painters' paintings. It's when it's a painting rather than a picture. You know, it's a very subtle difference, but, you know, when something's too illustrative as a painting, when the artist overtells it, overshares, when everything is contained in it and there's no room for ambiguity or interpretation, it's descriptive, it's overly descriptive. Whereas what I try to do is leave a bit of room for the viewer to come in. And so I think those parts of my process where I reveal the materiality, reveal certain aspects of the surface, I think that's a way of trying to do that.
It's also, I guess it's because the imagery you choose is very kind of photorealism at times. You're taking it from film stills, found imagery, your own photographs, but it is photographic sources that you are working from to create the painting. So I guess what you're saying is you don't want people to think this is a photograph that you've worked over, or this is a kind of piece of a found photography work that's then been manipulated.
Yeah, well, the photograph or the image that I find, It's a starting point often. Always it's a starting point, and then it kind of functions as a blueprint. But the painting, the technique, I always like for that to take it in a different direction. You know, so the image is the starting point, but then paint, the physicality of the paint kind of transforms it. And, you know, paint does something that photography can't do and, you know, all the other mediums can't do. It's really very plastic medium. You can just, you can take it in a different direction. So, yeah, that's important for me.
I think it's also imbued, paint for me is also imbued with history, with time. It always feels timeless, like it's been there. It's from the earth. It's kind of like lived a life, and there it is suddenly. This is how it is now. There's that magic of paint. That's why I think everyone is always drawn to painting above all. That's kind of in the hierarchy of art. It feels like paint is number one because of that, because it has this kind of depth, this it holds in itself history.
It's got a soul, hasn't it? Because it's so connected to nature, like when you make the actual pigments and you crush like minerals or rocks or crystals to make the colours. I think that's also linked to that idea of, like, I don't know, that we're all from some other planet or something. Do you know what I mean?
Mm.
Like,
you certainly are.
I know. I'll take that as a compliment. I got there in the end, babe. And also that idea that paint doesn't dry. You know, if it's oil paint in particular, like how oil paint can take like decades to actually...
Well, you know that Frank Auerbach story?
Oh, yeah.
So Frank Auerbach, you know Frank Auerbach, yeah. The painter? So his works are now coming up in auction, and they were made in the 40s, the 50s. They're so thick, the paint, that it's not even dry. So the surface is dry, but underneath it's still drying. Yeah. And it's going to continue drying probably for the rest of our lives and beyond. That blows my mind. You know what I mean? That underneath there is still wet paint. That was painted like 70 years ago.
That'll never dry either because this is too thick. It just creates a skin and then inside it just will never dry.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, if it's that thick.
What kind of paint do you use?
Oil paint.
Oil paint, yeah.
But I use it in a very different way, so I have very thin layers, whereas he's just straight from the tube.
It's quite dry, like the paint seems quite dry, what you use.
Yeah, so some of it is quite dry. I have this technique. I have lots of different techniques, but I'd say the one I use most is quite a traditional technique, old master kind of, where it's like the least amount of the best quality pigment I can find. So it's like super, super highly charged pigment and hardly any of it. And then if you use that on top of a very bright white gessoed ground, you get this luminosity, which you just can't get if you use, say, tube white. You know, it's counterintuitive. You think, okay, if I want to make a luminous painting or a very bright painting, or if I want to make a color lighter, I just squeeze in some white paint, but it actually does the total opposite. It makes this kind of horrible gray, like clagginess on the surface. So the best way to do it is just use very, very thin translucent paint over a white ground, and then the white of the ground functions as the white. You know, it's kind of hard to describe unless we have a painting in front of us, but that's, you know, in terms of my work, that's how I get that luminosity.
And why did you feel this kind of like draw to wanting to create images that have that luminosity? Is it something that you'd seen in like old master paintings or something? Because that's actually the kind of thing that I immediately connect with your work, is like having been in Rome, for example, in a church and like looking at some of those paintings. And you just don't get that light quality in a lot of contemporary painting. There are certain people that can do it and do it. But I feel like in your work, it's really, it has kind of a magical light.
It's like a fresco
quite
light.
Spiritual light.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's how I learned to paint. That's how I taught myself how to paint, really, is just looking at tons and tons and tons of paintings, and they're all historical paintings, you know, Renaissance, you know, pre-Renaissance, and, you know, figuring out, looking at them, thinking, how on earth did they do that, and just working it out and trying and testing it out myself. And so I think that's definitely where that technique has come from.
Where was you seeing these painted? You were brought up in the UK, right? Because Giovanelli is an Italian name.
Yeah, my dad is Italian, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
And but you were seeing these in the National Gallery, for example? Were you travelling around? Or?
Yeah, National Gallery. Really, it was when I first went to art school, I just started to do these, I call them pilgrimages to various cities and countries to see, like, museum collections. So it'd be like in Berlin or Cologne or Madrid, you know, the Prado, all these incredible collections of oil paintings and old masters, and just go there for a couple of days and just stare at these paintings. I just did that over and over again. Also in the UK, there's tons of great collections of paintings. And
like where should people be going to see these? Obviously National Gallery, but
National Gallery is a good one.
Wallace Collection,
I was just about to say, yeah. That one. Where I live, Manchester Art Gallery's got a great collection.
Where you've had a show?
Yes, I had a show there. I also did a few shows like around the North West, like the Grundy Gallery, Touchstones Gallery in Rochdale. You know, they've all got good collections. But just anywhere that I'd want to go for a trip, city break, first thing I'd do is find out, you know, what's there.
Oh, I love
it. Yeah,
that.
It's so fun, isn't it?
To plan a trip around an exhibition.
It also helps you discover a city, like in a way that you wouldn't otherwise. And there's nothing more magic, is there, than that, really? Especially if you do it with friends.
No, exactly. Why do you think it was that style of painting and that period in art history that you were drawn to? I mean, how old was you when you first saw these?
Well, probably growing up, I saw them maybe more in books or when I went to the National Gallery as a teenager, but I'd say 18 when I started my foundation.
But why do you think you were drawn more to them than you were to, say, contemporary painters or pop art?
I was drawn to all of that, and then this thing happened where, you know, I'd be looking at contemporary painters, say, or contemporary sculptors, and I'd be thinking, you know, how do they do that? Who are they influenced by? And then I'd find their influence, and then I'd do the same thing. I'd go, who are they influenced by? And, You know, after a while, I was somewhere in the 13th century, you know, because it's always this...
A door opens.
Absolutely. It's a bit like music. You know, music now, you think, how have they been influenced like that? And you find out who they were influenced by, and this succession of influence in reverse, and then you end up at the source. But there's never really a source because, I mean, there is, but, you know, you have to keep going back and back and back. So I think it was just that, just finding out, you know, where have these fundamental techniques come from?
You're an archaeologist.
That's a great word for it, yes.
Excavating, yes. Scraping back to light the surfaces of your painting.
Trying to find the originator.
Yeah.
But it's finding this, trying to find this simplicity, you know, where was it first done and when was it done the best, you know, and then it was, I ended up with the frescoes and Fra Angelico and Piero della Francesca and the Sienese painters, and yeah, it's just, I love history, you know, I love kind of exploring.
I do too. Tower of London, for me, I'm always walking around there seeing the boys, the brothers under the stairs where they found the remains, and this is where they cut off Anne Boleyn's head, and Traitor's Gate. I'm always like, this is just...
It's really interesting, that idea of frescoes as well. Like, Russell's really close friends with...
Hannah Quinlan and Rosie Hastings.
Yes. Well, I thought we finished each other's sentences. That's a talent, isn't it?
Yeah.
and they've been focusing a lot on frescoes recently within their work, and they're part of that Pinchuk Art Prize at the moment.
Yeah. But they went and travelled around and learnt how to do it with fresco makers.
Yeah.
Oh, really? I'd love to learn.
I was about to say, is that something that you would be interested in? Like getting away from the canvas maybe and onto a wall?
Well, you got an Definitely. Arts Council funding, did like a grant for you to go and do this research, didn't they?
Yes. Yeah. That was part of the research. To go on lots of trips and to to find out. I think I was mostly researching, Sienese and Florentine painting then. So I went to San Marco, the convent of San Marco, you know, with all those... It's like an old Domes. Monks. Yeah. And so then there's these incredible Fra Angelico paintings kind of painted on the, you know, right on the wall. And yeah, I would love to learn how to do that. That would be fantastic. Yeah. Also the like painting, like where you can't take it off the wall, you know, it's got this permanence to it.
Yeah.
It's totally, I imagine it's a totally different technique to a canvas where, you know, you can wipe it off if you really want to.
It's interesting, the idea of monks as well. So you made a painting, I think, called Host.
Yes.
I love that painting. Me it's too. One of my favourite works by you. Can you speak a bit about that work in particular? Because sometimes it's nice for our listeners, we can post it on our Instagram.
Yes.
And then, you know, go into a bit of depth about that one particular work.
Yes, that painting, that came from a much larger composition, which was a Fra Angelico painting called The Mocking of Christ.
Very good.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah, there's these three figures. There's this beautiful kind of triangular composition of, you know, this Jesus-like figure at the top, kind of in the middle, and then on the left there's this kind of looks like Mary, and then on the right there's this monk. And I think when I saw it, I was just very drawn to the monk's expression. It was just so kind of contemplative, and he was kind of looking down, and, you know, there's all this other stuff going on in the composition, but he was just kind of in his own space. And
even though Jesus is in the room, he's just
there was that.
Man, I've got other things on my mind.
That's it. He was, you know, this action's happening elsewhere, and he's just like, I'm in my own zone. Just something very tranquil and peaceful about his expression, and I wanted to focus in on that. And yeah, that's a technique I use quite a lot, which is this cropping. You know, maybe there's lots of other things going on in an art historical painting, and I'll just focus in on this one element that I find interesting or compelling in some way, and make the whole painting about that one area.
He looks like a Friar Tuck, doesn't he? Sort of.
Yeah.
It's interesting as well, like in those old paintings, how every single section of the painting is so charged in a way. Like, I feel like so much energy was put into even, like, I don't know, like a knife on a table or something. Or you know what I mean? Like, or the folds and curtains in the background, which we can get onto in a minute with your work. But
it's all there for a reason. Nothing is surplus or just like peripheral, like, oh, that'll do, shove that in there. Everything is
like
storytelling, because that's how people got all their information. And a lot of it was for God. This is an offering in some way, so it can't just be, everything has to mean something.
But by you, like, highlighting that monk, for example, like, what does that sort of, bring to your work? What does that achieve now, like, taking it out of that context and putting it into this contemporary moment? Because it's quite a specific approach, isn't it, to sort of highlight those moments?
Yeah, well, when I first... I mean, that monk that you saw at the Hayward, that's one of a series. I work in series quite often. Maybe there's, you know, 5, 6, 7 of the same image, but they're all kind of a little bit different how I approach them. But that the first time I showed that monk piece was here, actually, at this gallery in Workplace, when I had a show here in 2018, and the rest of the works in the show were all kind of, they were figurative, but had, they were much more verging towards the abstract. That's the first time I had the curtain pieces, like very, very large, kind of complex greys, very moody, really trying to create this mood and tone, and quite enveloping of the space. And then just this host piece, or I think I had two in the show, it's very, very small. You know, the size shift was quite extreme. And it's something about having those two things next to each other, these small portraits and the contemplative expression on the monk's face alongside these curtains, this kind of gloomy curtain thing. It just helps to create this atmosphere, this kind of very charged atmosphere that I was trying to have the show really push. It's almost like figures within systems. You know, it's kind of a psychological thing. I mean, these like very large, overwhelming systems, which are the curtains, or I was also doing these black leaf paintings that were quite, you know, very harsh monochrome things with like X's in them, and then just having this tiny little figure kind of with this expression. Yeah, I don't know what it created, but it did create this kind of very charged atmosphere.
Amazing. Yeah. Do you just go out and make these works and you suddenly go, oh wow, this all works together, this story? Or are you aware before you start bodies of work that you're going to have these, what these elements are? Because this feels very, we have got the monk as obviously religion, but then the curtains, these thick velvet curtains feel very theatrical, but also they feel like they're hiding something in a church. Religion feels like it's a real big element, and I'm not sure if you are religious yourself, but it feels like religion is a big element to your practice.
Yeah, it definitely is. You're not the first person to pick up on that. I'm an atheist, but I think I did have a very religious upbringing, so perhaps I'm just interested in it.
Catholic upbringing.
Catholic upbringing. Church all the time. I think but I still see the importance of religion as a kind of, you know, not that I literally believe in it, but I do think it's very powerful, and it created meaning for so many people. And in terms of art, it's just like the two things are just totally...
Especially that period.
Yeah, totally joined.
Yeah.
And, the show also that I just opened recently with Grimm Gallery in New York, that feels very religious, but in a kind of... But also there's this contemporary side of it as well. And you mentioned the theatricality of the curtains and... Yeah, I think, and the glitz and the glamour that you mentioned that you kind of got from the Hayward show, that's very prominent in this, because it's obviously a solo show, there's much more work to see, but all of them together really create this atmosphere of worship almost, but contemporary modes of worship. So there's these paintings of like pop star, and she's kind of spinning around, and she looks like a disco ball, and it's like gold and glitz and glamour, and there's these... big dominating diptych curtain pieces, and then there's the Carrie portrait.
Obsessed with that portrait.
So it's always about this, you know, the prom queen, the idea of theatre, performance, spectacle, contemporary modes of worship, really. You know, when we go and see a pop star and we pay to see a band, or, you know, we're really having a religious experience. We don't realise that we're doing it, but nothing's really changed fundamentally in terms of...
Our icons have changed.
It's an icon. It's a contemporary icon.
Different people, but the same. And that's what's really... That was kind of why I flippantly mentioned the thing about Donatella Versace and Dua Lipa. It wasn't just because I was name-dropping, even though you do know I love a name-drop. But but it was more that Dua, for example, walked in the room and she was actually like almost quite like an Amazon almost. She was like really tall and really like elongated in a way. So beautiful. But she was wearing these kind of sequin pink and yellow Versace outfit, and it actually really made me think about your paintings, because there was something within the construction of that look that I started to recognize in your work, this kind of like fascination with how images are created and also how icons are created, and also that kind of artifice, which might seem like, you know, theatricality, acting, all that stuff to some people may seem like you know, like you're pretending something, but actually it's the most honest, kind of truthful work to do.
And we suspend belief when we see an acting performance. We know that's a real person who has a real life, but we bind to it. We suspend belief when we see these performers on stage. We believe these songs. We want to be carried by you. And mm-hmm. that's what religion's always done.
Yeah, definitely. And I suppose that's what painting is as well. You suspend belief. That's what, yes. you know, when you go see a painting, you're peering into this pictorial space and you know it's artifice. You know, it's just mud on the surface.
Yeah.
But somehow it does something. Just like acting does, just like theatre performance, pop stars, fashion even. And again, that light is so fundamental with all of those things. I mean, when you go and see a pop star, like when you think about it, how important is light in that situation? It's like really important because it just...
Imagine if it's just a strip light above Beyonce.
Yeah, it just wouldn't quite...
really carry the same thing, no.
Well, not I don't know, quite. I think she'd rock it.
I mean, yeah, okay. I love everything Beyonce wasn't does. A good effect.
She'd manage
every moment she breathes, I love.
So when you talk about the process of time, how long does each painting take you? And can you talk us through the process of what it is, the layer upon layer?
Yeah, it's really hard for me to say how long each one takes because often I'm working on about 10 to 15 paintings at the same time.
Really?
Yeah. Because it's so slow, the way I work, it's oil paint, each pigment has its own drying time. Weirdly, you know, like a burnt umber will take, you know, one day to dry, and then an Indian yellow will take literally 7 days, and you're like, okay. So I can't work on you for a week, so I have to work on something else. So it's really important to just bounce things around, always be working on multiple things at the same time. But so, yeah, I don't really know how long, but I would just say it's slow, a slow process.
And how many layers are normally on each painting?
Well, it depends. Say the curtain piece is probably 5 layers. You start with an underpainting. That's often in like a kind of burnt umber or yellow ochre or something, like an earth colour, and then that dries and then you start to glaze over the top. It's very, you know, old master technique, quite traditional, but yeah, it's nice at the same time. And also that technique really helps seal the image in. I mean, you know, with the curtain paintings you saw at the Hayward, it's got they all end up with this sealing feel.
Like
you know, the
glaze over.
The very last one is like this opaque glaze just goes over the whole thing and just pushes it back into this space. I quite like that, trying to create two spaces within the canvas. So you have like the literal surface and then the pictorial image which you view through. So you're seeing the curtain, but then you feel like there's something just pushing up against it. You know. Creating, opening up a gap almost between the viewer and the image.
And actually, the fabrics is one of the things that I connected with immediately with your work. And the, like, for example, the repetition of like the gold shirt. I don't know if it's lamé or silk. It could be all different kinds of materials.
Yeah. Satin,
yeah. But I like that idea a lot. And I the thing I like about old master paintings is when you see the curtains in the background, often I end up not looking at the figure. I end up looking at the folds
in the fabric.
Do you
remember you did that stuff where you actually got told off, Tracy Emin told you off, because you used to keep cropping in on Instagram to fabric textures.
Yes.
You did the crop. He would have a whole feed.
That's
in
what
it.
I do.
Is it really?
He would go in and be like a bit of like a wool woven thing or this kind of like chintz pattern or this gingham or this whatever.
And like jacquard jumpers. And she actually wrote to me and was like, Rob, just go and do a textiles degree. Like, if you're so into this, just leave the gallery. It was really funny.
That's funny.
But yeah,
that's
so I've
why
always...
That's why the fabric stuff is really...
Exactly. And there's an artist I've worked with in the past and now called Edith de Kint. And when she was a kid, she used to draw obsessively and also sew. But she said she always used to draw the curtains in paintings. So I've always, with her work as well, she does these drawings where you like keep mark making and through the repetitive mark making, she actually creates images of curtains. But it's a completely different process to what
with
you're
graphite,
doing.
With graphite, isn't it?
Wow. So with
it
graphite, kind of and also with biro as well. And the way that the ink then sinks into the paper. And I really wanted to tell you about her because I think you'd love her.
Oh, I should look
work.
At look
it's
at
totally
her,
abstract,
yeah.
but
yeah.
it creates an idea of like, some people see trees as well. You know,
okay.
because it's like folds of fabric.
Yeah.
So what? How did you come to like wanting to present fabric in the painting?
I think, again, it's the interest in art historical. Fabric is just always present in every oil painting that you see. It's always like a figure and then fabric. It's something to do, again, it's the light thing is fundamental. I mean, I do it with hair as well. I'm very interested in the folds of hair and how light kind of hits hair and creates these kind of areas of reflection and then shadow, and that's exactly what happens with curtains or fabric, and it's how it reacts with light, I think, creates this kind of sublime spectacle thing going on. But yeah, with fabric, I think, yeah, it has to be the art historical thing. And
it's quite ominous as well. I find I feel like with a lot of your work, there's the curtains feel like what is behind there. We're not being shown that, and because they feel thick, they feel old, and there's like secrets behind there.
Mm.
You're talking about the moment in Carrie. This is a moment of ecstasy where she's being named prom queen, and we know what happens at the end of Carrie, where she just goes apeshit and kills everyone. But we're at this kind of moment, like a threshold where something bad's going to happen. There's a portrait of Tippi Hedren in Birds, the Hitchcock movie. But she's just about to be attacked by the birds. There's all these kind of moments, and you're capturing this element of, we know something bad is happening. We know something ominous is on the horizon, but the people you're portraying have no idea. Like the pop star spinning around, it makes me think of The Bodyguard with Whitney Houston, like singing a torch song, and suddenly she's got some stalker who might shoot or stab her. There's like this kind of
ominous threat.
Oh, wait, there's a threat to the works constantly. But it's really enticing. It's really kind of, it's like you're watching a movie, that moment in the movie where the music amps up.
Yeah, definitely. There's a filmic threat of, the threat is very prominent. I'm glad you picked up on that, actually. Yeah, there's always these moments where there's like emotional ambiguity. I mean, especially with the Carrie, with the Tippi Hedren portrait, that was just when she was being attacked by the birds, but her expression is, it's very ambiguous, you know. It could be like ecstasy. It could be that. It could be just screaming. You just don't know. It's like frozen in this moment. The same with the Carrie. It's just that moment when she's like really, really happy, and then we all know what happens after that, you know. And I suppose with the curtains as well, there's this sense of, you know, have I just missed something? Is something about to happen? This charged, you know. The curtain, stage is set, something is going to happen, action.
Something's about to be revealed, or you need to go and find out what's behind there, or don't pull back the curtain.
And it's like whether you're sat here, you know, in the audience looking at the curtain, or whether you're the other side as well. You know, whether you're the performer. Yeah. But there's definitely a filmic aspect to all my work.
These are all found images. You pause a lot of movies. It's never from the imagination, right? These are all images that you've sort of...
It's a mixture. I mean, yeah, the portrait ones, the Tippi Hedren, the Carrie, that they're found images, but they're from the actual film, and I slow it down and pause at just the right moment, and then I kind of put it through this process to create the what would you even call it? The kind of graininess.
The grade of it.
Yeah.
Of the 70s kind of quality, 80s quality of VHS tapes at the time. You celebrate that. These images that you're finding aren't crystal clear.
It wouldn't work.
Of pause when you're at home, when you're a kid, and you pause it on TV and you'd have that sort of like shake.
Flickering.
Yeah.
Yeah, it wouldn't work with like super HD, like Netflix movies now. There's nothing to work with. I mean, and again, going back to a conversation about the physicality of the paint itself, it's like, the image, it works a lot better when the image is kind of barely there, when it's just like a starting point, a reference, where it's not too oversaturated, too HD, because then the paint can't take it in any other direction. It just has to be kind of crap, the image. And then I can take it to the next level with paint. But if it was a HD, you know, super like highly rendered image, there would be no shadow, there'd be no kind of coloration, you know.
It's the depth that's missing in some ways.
Yeah, but that coloration of those films is very important. I mean, it just speaks to a certain time
like
era.
Kodak.
Yes, yeah, exactly. But also, I don't know if you saw the other paintings I did of the singers. They kind of, there was one or two at the Hayward. But
the long acrylic nails.
Yeah, that came.
You've got like a glitter ball kind of like sparkle goes through them. And again, the light has been a big
light
element.
Thing, light phenomena. But they came from old Soul Train videos, you know, of like 70s or 80s. And, you know, really...
And they had these long acrylic nails then.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's all back now, isn't it? It's like cyclical fashion.
Yes, they're so great. It's something, I was looking for backing singers that had these particular nails. It's important because, again, it's the glitz and glamour and the over saturation of like female beauty and
Was it specifically something about the backing singer, because like that's someone obviously in the background, a bit like the curtains were in the background as well or something?
Those particular backing singers were from, it was like Barry White and Love Unlimited, so they used to sing with him. But that series is called Caryatid, which is the name of, it's what you call those female statues that hold up Greek buildings, you know, where like they are the statue.
What are they called?
Caryatid.
Caryatids.
Caryatids, yeah. So they're like pillars, but they're shaped in the form of a female. And yeah, I was just interested in that connection, especially with backing singers, you know, the idea that there's this front man or front, you know, person who's singing at the front, and then, but actually what's happening at the back could potentially be more interesting, or that's actually keeping together the whole band, and, you know, they're always pushed to the back, but they're actually more integral to the music than perhaps even the front
man. The lead person, yeah, and also they're the kind of like the foundations, aren't they? They're
totally.
Like the strength within that whole structure.
Mm-hmm.
That's really interesting.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com, code program.
Hello, this is Russell Tovey and Robert Diamond from Talk Arts, the arts podcast, and we're here today with Budweiser beer, and we're going to be talking about something very, very important to both of us, aren't we, Rob?
That's right. Budweiser, the king of beers, has joined forces with legendary artist Sir Peter Blake, the godfather of British pop art and someone that both of us have adored since we were kids.
I've loved pop art since I was a kid, and Sir Peter Blake has been a constant for me, alongside other pop art artists, the Americans like Andy Warhol, Roy Lichtenstein, Keith Haring. And I got into pop art, Rob, because I loved cartoons growing up. I mean, I still love animation. But suddenly I discovered that so many artists were referencing comic strips and cartoons in their artworks, and I could go and see them in museums, and I suddenly didn't need to grow up. And Sir Peter Blake was one of these artists that meant so much to me. And I think people, if they don't know the name Sir Peter Blake, you would certainly know his work. The album cover for The Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club, Oasis's Stop the Clocks. These are iconic art historical moments that this artist has actually been at the forefront of.
And you've met him, haven't you?
I've met him, yeah, at the South Bank Show Awards years ago. I was there for the History Boys, and he was there, and I got incredibly excited and met him. But you've not met him before, have you, Rob?
I have. I've actually even been to his house and hung out with him and his wife, and I got to make an amazing print with him, which was a huge privilege, actually. It was a real career moment for me. So Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake have come together to unite, and they have created an exclusive limited edition beer can, which doubles as a collectible piece of pop art.
And it was on display at London's Truerman Brewery on the 23rd and 24th of March this year, if you were lucky enough to get there. And also, were you one of the lucky few that were able to get one of the signed beer cans by Sir Peter Blake himself? And there was something very special there, wasn't there, Rob? What was that?
They've actually made the first ever fridge frame, which kind of is reminiscent of what we would be, you know, accustomed with in terms of a museum exhibit. Yeah. But this fridge frame is designed to display the limited edition can of beer as a work of art, but also keeps the beer cool.
Okay, I need a fridge full of fridge frames because this sounds incredible. So Peter Blake's work adorns the cans with all of his eye-catching simplicity. It features the Budweiser's iconic red bow tie logo, but it's encompassed by the artist's signature and his use of block colours and icons. They unveiled this artistic can in all of its glory in one of these fridge frames, as Rob said, which is very exciting. The limited edition cans are available to purchase as a four-pack for a limited time only in selected Tesco stores nationwide.
Budweiser and Sir Peter Blake, thank you for bringing us this cultural moment. I love it when art reaches new audiences, and I really feel like this is going to go into everyone's homes, and is really joyous. So head over to Tesco, pick up a four-pack. Thank you, Budweiser.
But also, if you want to get this collectible piece of art at home, Budweiser also giving people the chance to own their very own exclusive fridge frame. Beer and art lovers can register their interest by visiting www.budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. That's budweiser.co.uk/Sir Peter Blake collab. Budweiser and talk art with Sir Peter Blake.
You're making us notice the overlooked.
Absolutely, yeah.
Is that what the repetition you're saying, like there's five or six versions of The Monk, there's five or six versions of Carrie, which is, the title of that is Auto da Fe, which actually means the burning of a heretic.
It does mean that, but it's the other meaning that I'm more interested in. It's a Portuguese saying which means act of faith. So, and that was the title of the show in Grimm Gallery. And like we were saying earlier, you know, this idea of contemporary modes of worship, when we go to see a performance or a theatre or a play, it's an act of faith, isn't it? These moments, like religious,
pilgrimages. But what does the repetition give you? And is every single one of your paintings another version of the same exist? Do you repeat everything, every image you make, or is it only certain images?
No, I repeat every image. Yeah, I hardly ever make just one painting. I always make at least two, three, four.
Is there a limit to like how many you would do?
Not consciously, but yeah, I never really go more than maybe eight. But the repetition, it's a device, and I really like to show them together as well. It's not like I'm just making them and then not showing them together. It's a decision to make, to repeat the imagery. It's like this testing again, testing the validity of the image to see like why am I interested in this? Why does this work as an image? And by testing it out and doing it a few times, you know, there's subtle changes that happen and it reveals things to me as the artist, but also to the viewer. And especially when you see them together, it creates a very eerie feeling as well in an exhibition if you see something two, three times, you know, and it's slightly different.
Will you hang them together?
I have hung them together, yeah, sometimes.
But they'd never be like a diptych or a triptych, they're individual works.
They're individual, yeah, yeah. So sometimes I hang them side by side, other times they've been hung, you know, one on that wall, one on the other side of the wall, the other side of the room. And it creates this uncanny feeling, you know, like, oh, I've seen that image before.
Yeah.
You know, and it's very bit spooky.
We interviewed Ronnie Horn a while ago, and she does photography. Sorry, they do photography, which is like the same person, but could be shot over the space of a minute. But in that minute, you might have had nature like raining on a person's face or what have you. And then you get these very different kind of images that almost look the same but aren't. Mm. And there is something really amazing about when you see one or two or three or four, but you get to see these slight subtle shifts. And it got me thinking a lot about this interrogation that seems to be the kind of bedrock of what you're all about in a way, into human psychology. Because even the way that like filmmakers will manipulate our emotions, you know, these kind of theatrical devices with music, but actually really with the visual moment, I find it so interesting within your work, that kind of like thread that runs through this like deep interrogation into psychology and almost like how we're controlled, you know, a bit like how religion can control, you know, people to act in a certain way en masse.
That's really
good. This excavating and like this constant trying to explore further and further and unravel. But there's a quote you said, I'm going to quote you.
Okay.
You can imbue seemingly simple images with meaning simply by painting them. So you're giving these simple things, I don't think they're that simple, but they might, you know, in the grand scheme of everything, but you're giving them something, you're giving them weight suddenly, and you're making, I guess by the repetition, making people really notice that image. If you have one image of something, you go, okay, I've got that, and you move on. But I guess if there's a few of them and they're slightly tonally different, or they might be slightly like different compositionally, like minutely, it does make you, which is what you seem to want, to slow down and really notice what you're showing us.
Yeah, definitely. And it reminds me of, I can't remember which one of you said it earlier on, but you know, just the very fact of using paint, oil paint, it's loaded, it's charged. So you make one mark and it speaks to the whole of art history.
Yeah.
You know, it's just incredibly charged medium, and I don't think any other medium necessarily has that. So yeah, if you're, and especially if you're a figurative painter, and you know, there's an image that maybe is part of everyone's collective consciousness, like they carry a little bit, or you know, certain images, and then you paint them in oil paint and you freeze them in time, it's like it really charges that image. And yeah, the repetition thing, it is definitely a way of, I talk about this quite often, yeah, trying to make the viewer slow down. Mm. I think painting can really do that over any other medium, especially in the art world. It's very fast-paced, isn't it? And, like, super kind of just quickly
got that.
Absorbed.
It's Instagram culture, isn't it? Got that like, move on.
Yeah.
That image, got that.
Yeah, scroll. Yeah, Whereas if it's, like, two images or three, it's like, look again, you know, just...
Well, something that I keep thinking about is this idea that, say, something like Carrie, it was a movie that obviously had millions of viewers around the world, and it really sort of struck a chord with people internationally. And then somehow it gets reduced to being like, oh, well, that's really popular, so it's not, you know, it's like throwaway or something. Mm. And that people forget that the reason it connects to such a massive audience is because there is something really amazing about that film. You know, it's like, I often think like pop culture gets like just sort of slagged off very quickly and then chucked away, when actually it, I think to represent it in your paintings is like, I don't know, it's kind of giving it a sort of new way of looking back at it or something, like a reverence or something.
Mm.
But I'm not sure.
Again,
if
it's making us like notice it again. But yeah. I think the thing with Carrie, and I was actually watching the end clip after like looking at this image again the other day, it's on YouTube. It is like a high school massacre by someone who is rejected, bullied, told they're a piece of shit, and at the end they get revenge and they kill everyone in the school. And this is pre the darkness of what we've seen over and over again in America with Columbine and stuff like that. This movie was kind of very future thinking of what the effects could be on someone if you antagonize them so much. I don't know what that says about your art, but I just think about, like, you're talking about how it then becomes... That's why Carrie is such a big reference point for movies and why it is referenced so much. And I guess why, you know, Carrie White is a great reference for you with your narrative.
I think there's definitely a threat of... It's that threat of violence, but the very subtle, and how it just... It's so close to desire and sex and all those things. Like, it's just... They bump up against each other, like an image like that, or even, I don't know if you saw the paintings I made of the Peeping Tom film, which is like a 50s British horror film, and it's about this guy who goes around with a camera, like a movie camera, and he's filming all these women, and then there's this one scene where he's filming this woman, and you can see her neck, and then the tripod comes up, and there's a knife in the tripod. There's this amazing image that I made into a painting of like a shadow of a knife on her neck. Yeah, so it's like this beautiful kind of reference to like the Renaissance, you know, these Madonnas, and like you've seen that neck, you've seen that female body so many times, but it's actually like a 50s British cult horror film. And this idea that, and she's actually in that scene, she's actually looking through the lens of his camera at her own death. So it's this like weird situation where it's like self-reflective, and then you as the viewer go kind of inculcated in that because we're watching that happen through his camera. So yeah,
it's, you can't stop it happening.
Yeah, it's almost like the threat, the kind of frenzied sort of violence versus like sort of ecstasy and kind of
tranquility, or just
calm
before the storm.
Exactly.
There is a really weird connection though in those movies between like violence and sex. I actually have a real problem with a lot of it now, because like I just feel like you see so much violence towards women in TV shows, in movies, like way more than you necessarily would see towards men. And I sometimes just have to turn things off, because I'm just like, I called Lindsay the other week. We were watching like a Norwegian...
It's Lindsay Mendick, who you know is a friend Instagram buddies.
Oh, okay. No, we just said hello on Instagram. That counts now, does it? Yeah,
of course. You're Bezos.
Anyway, I just have a problem with the way it seems to be perpetuated. It's like
Well, you couldn't watch The Handmaid's Tale.
Well, like, no, I ended up watching...
I watched it all, but that was relentless.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I watched the first series and it was incredible. And then I tried to watch the second series and it was so violent towards women that I just couldn't handle it.
No.
And then I skipped through a few episodes and then managed to continue. But it's just, I don't know, I just think it's a weird, it's a really tough one to kind of unpick, really.
Yeah.
On a happier note,
yes.
In your studio when you're making your work, do you listen to music? What are your favourite foods to eat?
Oh, okay. Yes, I listen to music. I listen to lots of podcasts. And
what podcasts do you listen to?
What do I listen to? I listen to, I'm quite interested, well, this one, Talk Art.
I was like, hello. You were late. I was like, oh, okay. Rude.
Took me a little while.
Other podcasts.
Every episode,
other podcasts.
All the hundred. Yes.
No, I did actually, the last podcast I listened to was you guys with Ralph. Yeah.
Oh,
I thought that was a really great one.
Yeah.
Oh, cool. Yeah. But yeah, it's usually podcasts, audiobooks, music. Because I paint for so long every day, literally like 8 hours. It's like there's only so much music you can listen to, and then you go a bit mad. So
you make yourself go to the studio every day?
Oh yeah, I go every day. Yeah.
What, like weekends as well?
Yes.
So this week you've been in London. Do you have a sketchbook?
No, this has been my. It's a week off, yeah, but then I go back and
you'll be straight in there.
I know, I should take a bit more time off, but
and this is because
I get itchy, you know, if I'm at home and I can't really take any time off. I just
you're in Manchester,
yes, yeah, studio's in Manchester.
How far away do you live from the studio?
Oh, hard to say, maybe half an hour on the public transport, yeah.
When you have a week off like you've just had, do you find yourself still thinking up ideas of like, yeah, next works?
Oh God, yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, like, and I said, I do feel quite like, oh, eager to get back and just need to get in there.
Did you go for his masters?
I did go, yeah.
Did you get photos of crops of any masterpieces in there?
There was so many, wasn't there? It was just, it was amazing. Yeah. I kind of, I wish I'd started at Fries Masters and then gone to Fries, because it was just, I felt a bit fatigued by the time I got to Masters. I was like, oh my God, heavy hitter after heavy hitter after. It's just incredible, everything in there. Amazing.
I'm beginning to realise that, like, you know, you just said, like, I should take more holidays. Mm-hmm. And, like, I think Russell and I feel the same sometimes. But then when I go on holiday, I just end up wanting to make more,
you take the equipment
more podcasts
away.
Or more, you know, more, I don't know, looking at more art or even, like, trying to find collectors for art or that kind of thing, like, you know.
Well, art infects everything, doesn't it? And if you're thinking about it all the time. Yeah, it's even, like, if I go on holiday, I'm just going to art galleries. So it's not really a... Well, it is a holiday, I suppose, but you're still thinking, like, okay, I have to go see this painting, I have to speak to this person, I have to do this. It's like...
Well, I guess that means we found our...
Work is
our,
more fun than fun.
Yeah, we've kind of... Oh, yeah. You know, you found your purpose in life.
Do you ever get frustrated with yourself that you've given yourself such a hard technique or a laborious technique to create your art? Do you ever think...
so meticulous.
Why have I not just made it easy for myself?
Funnily, like, I think I would find it more difficult to not use any of these techniques. You know, I'd find it... What's horrifying to me is the idea of just a blank canvas and then I just paint something. From my imagination, like, that, I couldn't do that. I'm just not that type of artist who's wired that way. Like, I'm... When someone can do that really well, I'm blown away. I think it's so clever. But so these processes, these techniques, I've been perfecting them for years now, and it's like, it's quite methodical. You know, it's like, I know how I'm going to approach this now. I need to do this underpainting. Then tomorrow I'm going to do this part and this part and this part. And that compartmentalizing of all the different
routine
parts.
Routine within a routine.
It is a routine. Yeah, I do like the routine of it. Yeah. I mean, there's still plenty of room for maneuver and, you know, inventiveness within that. But I need these like building blocks, these kind of integral building blocks are really important for how I make the paintings. Yeah.
And how do you feel now? Like the show Mixing It Up, you are... For me, one of the standout artists in that show, and there's a lot of artists in there, your work, and you're getting a lot of attention, and a lot of people are wanting to acquire your work and museums. What does that feel like at this stage in your career and as a person, as an artist? How are you dealing with all that?
Yeah, it is a bit overwhelming sometimes. I mean, I think just having all these things come at the same time, like the Hayward show, the Grimm show, Freeze, all in the same, you know, opening week, it's like... Yeah, can be a bit overwhelming in the attention, but ultimately I know I can just go to the studio and close the door and, you know...
Turn your phone off.
Yeah, just... Yeah, turn off notifications helps a lot.
I guess dealers are happy that you're making multiple versions of favourite paintings that people want. You know, the carry one I'm obsessed with.
Yeah.
Obsessed. And how many versions of that are there?
Currently three.
So it's currently three.
Yeah.
One was at Fries, one was in the Hayward show from here.
No, it wasn't in the Hayward show, no.
That's not in the Hayward show?
No, I think you're thinking of the Tippi Hedren one.
Tippi Hedren's in the Hayward show, but that was in the show here with Carrie as well. No, that was the Grimm Gallery one, Carrie's.
There's one in the Grimm show currently, and there's one on the Fries booth at the moment.
And the other one is still...
The other one... Oh, there's two in the Grimm show.
Russell's just trying to find out where it is.
No.
I'm sorry.
How do I locate?
He's so naughty.
I love that
one. Like, and it's currently in Manchester. What is it? He asked you earlier. He's like, how far away do you live from your studio? Can you tell us the route? He's like desperately trying to get to your studio.
I love that one.
I see.
But that's good though for people that love images that you have multiple versions of, like, so how many of there are Tippi, for example? And
yeah, I can't remember now, maybe five or six. But yeah, it's, I mean, plenty of artists do that, have done that in art history, you know, like Manet, there's many versions, Picasso's, there's like eight versions, I think. It's like a very common thing that artists will, like I said earlier, like this, the repetition, it's like a testing of the image. So, you know, and then you get, you know, connoisseurs of Picasso be like, oh, this is definitely the best one. Oh no, this one's definitely the best one. It's, yeah, I like that idea of it in the series. You know, and they're always different, like I say, so the ground might be a different colour, or I might slightly change the cropping, and you know, and then a few months will go by and I'm like, the last one was definitely the best one, or the first one was definitely the best one.
Yeah,
and framing as well, you tray frame a lot of your smaller works, and then there was a work you painted on a book, which is incredible, and you've sort of float mounted that so you can see the edges of the book. A lot of artists, the framing isn't something they really consider, but it feels like something that's part of the kind of language as well with your work.
Yeah, the framing. I never used to frame things, but I think especially with the smaller ones, it helps. You know, if you get a really nice thin frame and the wood, you know, you can kind of get it tinted a colour that's actually within the painting itself. I think it really helps just give it a bit more weight. The big ones, not so much. I like them to be, you know, on their own. But yeah, small ones, I think it's a nice touch.
Is your experience as an artist quite a solitary one? Or is Manchester a place where you have like a big peer group of artists and a kind of artistic community that's like supportive?
A bit of both. I think I am a solitary artist. I studied in Frankfurt, the Städelschule, for 2 years. And
say that again.
The Städelschule.
That's right.
Yeah, that's where I did like equivalent of an MA. And before that, I'd been working and, you know, practicing artists on my own and doing shows, and then going back to working in a studio, like a communal studio of people, I found a bit difficult, but great at the same time. But yeah, when that was done, I just back to my old studio again and closed the door. And yeah, I find it hard to paint with people also there. You know.
We used to go and visit Cubit in London, like a long, long time ago, like about 15 years ago. And I always remember sitting in a studio visit there with Ellen Cantor, and who's now passed away, sadly, but she was an amazing artist. And I remember sitting in her studio visit, and you could hear all the other artists in their other rooms. And it was really weird, because I was like, you don't actually get to sort of just lose yourself in that moment. You really have to, like, tune out from all the noise.
Yeah, that's what, some music or headphones or, I mean, a little bit of, you know, it's nice. I mean, I'm in the communal studio at the moment. I'm going to move actually to a much bigger one soon. But a little bit of buzz outside is always nice, you know, and being able to be like, right, put the paintbrushes down, go have a coffee or a beer or something. That's great. But, it's like trying to find the balance between those two things. I don't think I'd like to be in a big studio just on my own, like no one else there. I do like to be connected to other artists. I think it's important, you know, to have those conversations. And I think.
And who
like
are
that.
Artists that you respect and admire within your kind of generation?
Oh God, I don't look at that much. I really,
oh, really?
Don't know. I mean, there are some. I can't think off the top of my head, but I find it. If I look at too much art that's going on now, especially like people my age, it's too. Too much
distracting.
Yeah, it is. I really like to just not just focus on my own stuff.
Yeah,
that way you don't start other people's ideas, don't get mixed up in your own, and the other way. It's
interesting. Yeah. And what about Manchester as a location? Is Manchester somewhere that gives you inspiration and you feel?
Yeah, I love Manchester. I think I really love the city. It's very vibrant, a lot going on music wise. It's amazing. It's meant, being in Manchester has meant that I have been able to basically be full-time artist since I graduated, you know, just because it's not as expensive as London and get a much bigger studio there. And yeah, the history there I really enjoy as well, like all the red brick buildings, the mills, the industrial history of it all. So
do you feel like you might end up having a location here as well at some point in London?
It's not something I'd rule out. Yeah, I could have two studios, three studios.
Well,
yeah.
Surely Italy or something. Surely you should have a studio.
Yeah, I mean, God, there's so many great locations, aren't there? But yeah, as a base, Manchester's really great. But yeah, I love travelling around. I've done a few residencies. I spent a while in New York to open my new show. And yeah, I was in Dubai before that. That was super weird. Did I tell you about that?
No.
Well, you know, because there's still restrictions on UK to US.
Yeah.
So I couldn't, you can't go to the US unless if you've been in the UK or Europe for 14 days. So I had to go and just like sit in Dubai for 14 days. Wow. So that I could fly to New York. That was an experience.
But did you have to stay isolated in your hotel room? Or?
No, you just have to not be anywhere in Europe or the UK. So it's just about the passport. So they stamp it like, right, you've left on this day, and then you can just do what you want for 14 days.
They've got great museums there, though. Like, collections there are incredible, no? Did you
are they?
See anything?
I didn't, no. So I didn't see much. I didn't know. I mean, yeah, I did go do a bit of sightseeing, but it was like 45 degrees. I was just done.
Major heat.
I just sat by the pool, yeah.
Well, talking about restrictions, like being locked down, how it affects artists, there was a certain happy accident which I discovered about you. You talked about hair earlier on and the luminosity and light hitting hair. Mm. But because you didn't have a lot of access to real hair, I guess, you purchased a lot of wigs?
Yes. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, the new hair pieces at the moment, the Plexus works of the blonde hair,
yeah.
they're from wigs. Yeah, I've got a ton of wigs. But also, I could access people's hair if I really wanted to, but then you have to deal with the person as well. So I'd rather just have the wig and then
or
you
scalp
can...
scalp them and then give it back.
That's it, yeah. It's more
like one of the horror movies. I'm not going to be watching.
Well, yeah, but the hair again is like from behind, close up of someone's hair. It's like that movie kind
of
image of Hitchcock. Yeah. You kind of see someone looming behind, about to grab, you know, the hair. The woman, whoever's got carrying that hair,
yeah,
is about to be.
Yeah, again, yeah. Thinking about films, that's how I first, I think, became interested in the idea of like the back of a woman's hair is from the Tarkovsky film. I can't remember, is it Solaris? I can't remember which one. It's just like a shot, a really slow shot of the back of her neck and hair. And yeah, you just see it and it just reminds you of the Renaissance and yeah, all of this historical weight to it. But yeah, the wig thing, it's all about just being able to have that time to control the light and create the tone and the shadow and like move the light in certain ways to create these reflective areas and
so you'd properly set it up like in the studio with the lighting
I've got like a what mannequin head thing and put it on and like move the hair in certain ways and light and
did you ever do life drawing or was drawing a big thing you did when you were sort of learning all of these skills, because I feel like you're a very skilled artist.
I have done life drawing before, but I have to say drawing's never been such a big part of what I do. It's usually I attack the canvas like straight away. I don't really think in line. Like I think in volume and tone and light, you know. So that's why when I was talking about underpaintings, you have a canvas and you cover it completely with a colour and then you pick out the light value. So you literally like wipe the paint off and that creates the tone and the shape. Whereas drawing is much more like, you have to think very differently. I think it's more difficult. It's really difficult to draw.
It's like a really 3D kind of concept 3D. Of painting.
Yeah,
that's really interesting.
It's like modelled and kind of rendered. That's how I think in terms of shape. So whenever I'm looking for images or, the images that always kind of strike me that, I encounter are always ones that are to do with light and tone and volume, and it's never a line thing or a drawn thing. Okay. Yeah.
So you'll be back in studio on Tuesday if you travel back Monday, or would you go straight to studio Monday?
Yeah, probably go straight back. But yeah, I need to get back because we're moving studios, so I need to start building some walls. Yeah.
That's exciting.
Yeah.
So we ask every guest two questions. The first is, if you could do an art heist, which we will support you, we will bring lorries and vans and helicopters and Donatella Versace.
We're going to lawyer up in case anyone tries to sue you for stealing.
You're totally legally protected. What artwork would you heist? Or it could be anything, really, like from history.
I think it would probably be... can I take a fresco off the wall?
Yeah. We can just take... No, we'll take the whole wall. We'll take the...
Yeah, we knocked down
the whole structure.
Yeah.
We'll move mountains.
They can do that, can't they? They can actually take frescoes off
the wall.
And Banksy's and things like that get taken off now, don't they? Or the street artists.
Wow.
People, like, literally take all the bricks out of the wall and then reconstruct it and sell it at Christie's. Awful.
Wow, I didn't know that. Okay.
It is awful, but he does do that for, like...
charities.
Well, I don't think it's well. I think it's nice when there's like someone that's struggling, and then they put Banksy appears.
Yeah, yeah, that's
then
true.
They're able to take that wall down, sell it, and then they get.
Yeah, the charity gets the money. No, that's true.
These appear, but anyway, sorry. Fresco.
Fresco.
Probably a Fra Angelico fresco from the San Marco convent. Any of them? Yeah, I can't remember the names. Maybe there's one called the Mocking of Christ. I feel like that's one of them. But
and what yeah. Where is that in Florence?
Yes, the convent of St. Marco, which I think is in Florence, I'm pretty sure.
Amazing.
Yeah. I just take the whole room as well, because it's very... You don't get this a lot with painting, do you? But as soon as it's a fresco, it becomes this zone of contemplation. You go in and the light's very low and it's like a low ceiling and you've got this archway. So I just take the whole room and put it in my house. That would be good.
Cool.
That is a religious experience for you then.
Yeah, it is. It's not just about the painting. It's like this experience, this psychological change of like entering and being at one with this image. Yeah, it's very religious, isn't it?
Yeah.
But that's also how it's constructed. It's like how, that's almost how, because spirituality, I think, is more within us. But I think like religion and those structures, that's kind of like a technique they've used, including light. Like you're talking about the dimmed lights, the hush, the kind of elevation of...
And the frescoes on the ceiling or panels on the ceiling. So you have to look up, which is about contemplation of...
Yeah.
I remember going to the Vatican in Rome and just being so blown away by the, you know, the paintings on the ceiling and like, and actually how it does elevate everything, and it does feel so joyous and so like, it's amazing the psychological effect it can have on you.
Well, you don't get that experience in daily life where you're looking up. How regularly do you look up?
No, it's true.
In your surroundings above you. Yeah. You don't really, we're all kind of forward thinking or down to the floor of our phones.
Well, painting really used to change people's behaviour, didn't it? I mean, what you're saying about the, you know, going to those places where the painting's all over the ceiling, I mean, that was obviously the intent, wasn't it, to go in and just literally changing people's behaviour. I suppose we have it with different things now.
Mm.
Painting doesn't do that so much anymore.
If you paint the ceiling, it would.
Yeah.
It would be celestial.
Yes. What is your favourite colour?
Probably turquoise green.
Turquoise green?
Something, turquoise green.
And why turquoise colour?
I don't know. I guess because it's sits somewhere in between green and blue. I don't. Yeah, probably more of like a grey version of that. Probably, you know, the colour of the curtain that is in frieze, that colour, which is like grey green.
Like iridescent-y sort of.
Yeah. Does it make you sort of feel like
that colour?
Yeah. For you to choose that particular colour.
Invincible.
I don't know. It's contemplative, I guess. Because it sits somewhere between, like in the middle of the colour spectrum somewhere. Like red is too much, isn't it? It's like, and like blue, just the idea of blue is too much. It needs to be muted, pastely, somewhere in between.
Wow.
Yeah.
Do you live with your own art, like in your house?
No, and I need to change that. I don't have a single one of my own paintings in my house.
Oh, really? Yeah, you must keep some.
I'm good, yeah.
Do you hold stuff back, though, for your...
No.
So you clear your studio out every
time? Yeah, it's really bad. Actually, I've made a decision. Like from the New York show, I've kept one painting. Your favourite painting.
Oh, that's good to know. And you make
now he knows where it is. He can do an art heist.
Yeah, I know where it is.
How do you feel when the work leaves you and it goes to collectors and you don't see it again? Do you feel bereft or are you okay with it?
Yeah, I think I had to overcome that a while ago. Just had to accept it. But it is a shame now with all empty walls in my house. I'm going to change that a little bit and, have my own collection. But, whatever. It has its own life now. It enters the rest of the world. Sometimes the collectors show me where they put it, though, and I like that. You know, it's good. Good to see where they end up.
Oh.
What is the... Final question. What is the best advice you have ever had?
Ever had? In terms of...
When it comes to your art...
Oh, God, what is the best advice? Probably just go into the studio. Just make it a routine. Just work really hard, really. Yeah, in art school, they'd just be like, you're not going to learn how to paint unless you practice it. You know, the 10,000-hour rule thing?
No, what's that?
I can't remember who said it now, but there's this idea that if you want to perfect any kind of skill, you have to do it for 10,000 hours, you know, whether it's a musical instrument or anything. 10,000 hours is where you have to get the skill. So I'd say the 10,000-hour rule.
Painting.
How many years is that? What does that work?
It's basically what we've just done with Talk Art Babes over the last 3 years. It feels like 10,000 hours.
And we haven't perfected it. What's going wrong?
We're still absolutely useless.
And to flip that then, what's the best advice that you would give a younger artist now that's listening?
I honestly just probably the same advice. It's just like you have to practice. It sounds quite boring, doesn't it? But just practice what you're doing. You have to be good at what you do. You know, there's this whole idea of like, it's not what you do, it's who you know. That's not right. It's definitely, that's not, that's bullshit. Like, you have to be good, and then it can become important as well who you know. But if you just know people or just connected and you're not very good, like, those people aren't going to, because it looks bad on them, right, to promote you. You have to be good at what you do so that then the connections are valuable. But this whole idea of like, oh, it doesn't, you know, don't worry about the skills, the techniques, the actual art. It's all about like the networking and the schmoozing and
it's
where
so
you
nice,
live and
yeah,
all
yeah.
of that is, I'd say, very secondary. You just have to really perfect what you're doing and have confidence in the art that you make and love the art that you make, and then all of that comes.
And you love your own work.
Well, not. I always know when I finish it, I always don't really like it, but I love it when I'm making it.
You're not one of those artists who, if you went to a collector's house and you saw it, you'd want to like start changing it.
Oh God, yeah, probably. Well, I don't see it so often. See them so often in collector's houses, but yeah, probably, yeah. But then sometimes I have the opposite thing where something leaves my studio. I'm like, oh God, that is so terrible. I can't believe. I just wish I had one more week on it, but it has to go. And then I see it a few months down the line. I'm like, who made that? That's great. Sometimes it's that, but then other times it's like, I think it's really great and I'll see it again. I'm like, oh, that's shocking. So it's a bit of both.
That might just depend on your mood on the day.
I think so.
All the works I've seen by you are extraordinary.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, thank you.
Thank you so much for spending this hour with us. And by the way, if you heard like rumbling, it's because we're actually in a gallery that's like lower level, and there's a tube that keeps driving past. I keep hearing it going to Oxford Circus. I actually really love it. I feel like it's super atmospheric, which is...
Well, it's the archaeology of London, isn't it?
It is.
Peeling back the layers.
That's
like
it.
You need another 10,000 hours, darling. That was a really like embarrassing outro.
For all images, please go to @talkart on Instagram. And you're on Instagram?
Yes, Louise___Giovanelli.
Oh, three underscores.
Three
layers.
That's it.
There we go.
Gap between the names.
Layer.
And we are in the Workplace Gallery. They let us in, so thank you very much, Workplace.
They let us in.
They let us record here at 40 Margaret Street, where you had your inaugural exhibition.
Yep.
So thank you very much, Workplace, and thank you very much, Grimm Gallery, and for everything else, just...
Go to @talkart, and we'll be back very soon.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks,
it's been great. Bye.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram @talkart, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.